California is building a system to track sexual harassment complaints filed by state employees, but the state used to have a system. On Insight, Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd with a look at the gap of information created when that old system was eliminated. Then a recue of my conversation with California Assemblywoman Wendy Carrillo. She was the only state lawmaker to travel with Governor Newsom to El Salvador in the spring of 2019. Her family had immigrated from there when she was a child. We spoke while she was traveling with the governor. And we'll listen again as author Reina Grande shares more of her immigrant story in a new book titled A Dream Called Home. She was separated from her parents as a child and ran across the border, becoming undocumented. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. California's legislature was rocked by revelations in the fall of 2017 that several lawmakers were investigated and in some cases disciplined for sexual harassment in the workplace. The story became part of the larger conversation within the Me Too movement. Cap Radio's state government reporter Scott Rodd has been looking at why California lawmakers and leaders seem to have a hard time answering basic questions about sexual harassment in state government. And Scott's joining me right now to focus on some aspects of his reporting. Hi, Scott. Glad to have you in the studio.
Good morning, Beth.
So California is now building a system to track sexual harassment complaints that are filed by state employees. But in your reporting, you say the state already had a system to track complaints, but eliminated it in 2012. What happened? Why did the state eliminate it?
So that's right. The state did have a system in place to track sexual harassment complaints and analyze trends, analyze where there may have been problem departments, where there may have been increases in these complaints. And in 2012, they eliminated it. This was part of a much larger effort to consolidate government programs and government agencies and specifically reorganize how human resources was handled in state government. And as part of that reorganization, they eliminated this tracking system. Now, why specifically they eliminated this tracking system as part of it, it was something that I wasn't able to pin down. I asked some folks who were involved in the reorganization, and they didn't have a very clear memory of it, partly because this reorganization was a pretty monumental task. It involved changes to over 70 parts of the California state law just to have it happen. And this was, you know, one piece of that much bigger puzzle.
It was a different time. The national debate was different, certainly then, and within California in particular. But what was the impact of eliminating that system?
You're right. This conversation has come up, has emerged as a much more important topic of conversation in the last couple of years. And the impact of eliminating this system was that when the state was confronted with the fact that they have issues with sexual harassment in their own ranks, they didn't have data to examine what exactly their issues were, where the problem spots were, because there was that 7-year gap after they eliminated the system in 2012 up until now, where they weren't tracking that high-level data. This is the head of CalHR, Irena Ortega, and she discussed this issue when I sat down with her.
When the issue was really at the height of interest last year, there wasn't an ability to even answer questions about what the state's experience was. So there was a lot of public discussion about other industries and types of issues that were being discussed, and we couldn't speak to anything about what the state was experiencing.
And so there you're hearing her say, you know, in media and in Hollywood and in sports, there were all these ongoing conversations and discussions about what their experience was. But when people turned to the state and said, okay, well, what's happening at the Capitol? What's happening at agencies? They found they didn't have that data or information available.
I understand the gap in time, but does the state currently collect any data on sexual harassment complaints?
So individual complaints are currently submitted to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, and those complaints are reviewed, processed, and if necessary, investigated. However, they don't produce reports that examine potential patterns, that analyze broader trends in sexual harassment complaints across state government. And that is where people say you can really identify the problematic picture. I spoke with a former lawmaker, Sarah Reyes. She was actually the assemblywoman who introduced the law that requires training for supervisors on sexual harassment prevention. And she brought this up in our conversation that simply processing individual complaints isn't enough. You need a bigger picture.
It is unbelievable to me to think that when you consolidate state government, the one thing that falls off the table is the tracking of sexual harassment. We shouldn't wonder why we're talking about the Me Too movement and the legislature when they didn't make it a priority.
Even though the state is collecting some information or processing some information on sexual harassment complaints, she's saying that if you don't have that bigger picture, you're not going to have a full grasp as to how big or how serious the issue actually is.
You have to wonder whether having had a complaint tracking system in place might have reduced the number of sexual harassment incidents and settlements in recent years. Is there some thought about that?
There is. It's hard to say definitively, right? Because you're sort of speculating and it's something that would be difficult to prove. However, the head of government operations, who was actually part of a working group that recommended that this system be brought back, she had said to me, you would hope that having a system in place would have reduced incidents and would have reduced the number of settlements. Beyond that, part of the justification for bringing back this system when Governor Jerry Brown had requested additional money in the budget for it last year, one of the reasons that was cited was there's inconsistency and there are high dollar settlements that have come in recent years. And that was part of the justification for bringing it back. So while it's tough to prove whether or not it would have in fact reduced the number of incidents, that was its purpose. Its purpose was to reduce misconduct and incidents. And if the system was effective, it seems like, yes, it probably would have.
I'm talking with Cap Radio State Government reporter Scott Rodd. He has been following the reporting and tracking of sexual harassment cases at state agencies in California. The state is building a new system for tracking harassment complaints. What will that system do?
So as I mentioned earlier, Governor Jerry Brown formed a working group in 2018. They examined how they should improve policies related to sexual harassment. One of the findings was they needed to bring back this system. And right now they're developing it. It's going to be a software-based system where it automatically collects this complaint data, centralizes it, and they can produce a report on it every year, and they can examine to find if there are trends. Before the system was eliminated in 2012, the information was collected manually, which obviously is takes time, takes additional money and manpower, and perhaps there may not be the ability to examine it as in depth. So one thing that was touted about this new program is that it's going to be a bit more sophisticated than the one in the past. And they're looking to have it launch by early 2020. Previously, they wanted to have it launch at the end of last year. That timeline got pushed off a little bit, but the government is confident that it'll launch in early 2020.
Earlier this year, Scott, you looked at sexual harassment training in state government, and your reporting found dozens of state agencies that had failed to train nearly 1,800 supervisors in the past few years, and that was in violation of state law. So are there any new developments in that story?
There have been some developments. Governor Gavin Newsom's office had said that the administration set a deadline of July for agencies to get into compliance with these sexual harassment training laws. So we are halfway through July, and I had reached out several times to the administration without hearing back. Finally, just in recent days, I got a very generic response that said that all agencies were now in compliance and that they would continue to monitor it. However, my specific questions weren't answered, such as what did this compliance look like? Which agencies had now achieved this compliance? the specifics simply weren't provided. We've since put out a public records request to get these training logs from all these agencies to see, in fact, if they are in compliance. Mm-hmm. So we certainly are still monitoring it, and we want to know specifically where these agencies stand.
Well, thank you. I'll refer everybody to capradio.org to see expanded coverage on these multiple stories under that umbrella of sexual harassment.
Thanks, Beth. I appreciate it.
That is Scott Rodd. And again, you can find his coverage at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Assemblymember Wendy Carrillo was the only California lawmaker to join Governor Gavin Newsom on his trip to El Salvador. That trip happened in April of 2019. Carrillo's family had immigrated from El Salvador when she was young. The trip by the governor was timely with the ongoing humanitarian crisis at the border, and the assemblymember joined us while they were traveling. You will hear her reference people who have TPS, or temporary protected status.
California is home to close to 700,000 Salvadorians, 50,000 of which are TPS recipients. There is a very direct connection with the state of California to the country of El Salvador. And the more that we've talked to organizations and government officials, it's very clear that there is a direct link between the state and the country. And so when you think about the population of California, we're talking about people that have immigrated and built a new life in the state.
That said, should previous governors have gone? For example, should Jerry Brown have made this same kind of trip?
Every governor has different interests and approach policy in different ways. And Governor Newsom wanted to take a very personal, in-depth approach to the root causes of migration. So he prioritized coming to El Salvador because he really wanted to understand. There are some electeds that choose to look at issues from a balcony point of view and have advisors, people that can tell them about the issue. And Governor Newsom took the approach of actually wanting to get into the weeds of things and actually talk to people and build relationships, because El Salvador plays a big role within the state of California.
El Salvador was your childhood home. It must be quite a personal experience to be there in this way. And as I ask you that, would you also set the stage for your own story that began there?
It's really powerful for me personally to come back to my country of birth in this new capacity as a member of the assembly and as someone that's been invited to come to the country and have conversations about the root causes of migration and the economic issues that are very real to people here in this country. I came to the United States when I was 5 years old during the Civil War, which was 12 years long. And we immigrated not because we wanted to, but because we needed to in order to survive, in order to live. And that, I think, is a conversation that is often missing when people talk about why people immigrate, why people flee violence and war, and why they choose to do whatever they can to provide a better life for themselves and their families. That's the stage in which I see this trip for myself, as being the only representative of Salvadorian origin in the state legislature in this moment in our nation's history, where we're seeing anti-immigrant sentiment, when we're seeing people from the triangle countries of El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala immigrate because of deep, deep poverty that hasn't been addressed in El Salvador in particular since the war. Being here, being in El Salvador and meeting with the president and meeting with the ambassador and learning about how much the United States is actually investing in El Salvador gives me hope and gives the people of El Salvador hope. And that investment, which is, we call foreign aid, is actually a boost to the local economy here in terms of jobs, in terms of prosperity. So if we truly want to think about curbing the regular immigration, we have to look at what the U.S. is currently doing to invest in this country following so much devastation after the war.
Your mom went first to the United States seeking asylum. What year was that?
My mom must have left El Salvador somewhere between 1982 and 1983. I was 2 years old and came to the United States seeking political asylum and was denied. But she understood that we didn't really have a lot of choices. So she stayed and she worked really hard to save money to send for myself and her mother, my grandmother. And it took about 3 years for her to save that. In about early 1986, we immigrated from El Salvador to the United States. And I often think about what my journey would have been if I were doing that today. Because very much like the young children that are leaving and fleeing violence, my family was fleeing war. If I were a five-year-old now, what would my chances be? Would I have been separated from my grandmother at the border? Would I have been put in a cage? Would I be living the rest of my childhood life in a detention center? And I don't have that circumstance now, but I do feel a sense of responsibility in having had opportunity and having a very similar story and now being in this incredible position to be able to talk to my colleagues and to advocate for what is needed and what is just, to make sure that at the end of the day, the policy that we work on both in the state and on the federal level has a human perspective, that we are talking about people and human lives. And I think that is often missing.
Assemblymember Carrillo, do people in your district have communication with you about this trip? Are you hearing from them? What's their reaction?
People in the district are incredibly proud that I represent them because I am Salvadorian American, who is very rooted in my own roots and can advocate on a variety of different issues. So whether it's this mission that we're on now, or whether it's the issues that impact our community at home, which are homelessness and housing and education and health care, none of these issues are separate from one another. We have families that are of Salvadorian descent or of Mexican descent and of other ethnicities that are facing all of these issues. As I mentioned, California is home to 50,000 people that received, Salvadorians in particular, that received temporary protective status during the war. And some folks have asked the question, well, why haven't they applied for residency or citizenship? And when I explain that the federal law does not allow a TPS recipient to receive or have a pathway to residency or citizenship, it changes the conversation. So when we talk about comprehensive immigration reform, it includes TPS recipients. We're not just solely speaking about the 11 million undocumented people that live across the United States. We're also talking about TPS. We're talking about permanent residency status, citizenship, asylum, refugees. And so that is what comprehensive immigration reform is. And so I know that my constituents, and even beyond that, for folks across the state of California, who are of Salvadorian or Central American heritage, they're proud to have somebody that represents them, that understands their issue, because I have personally lived it. And that, I think, makes me a little bit more sympathetic to the issue and can be a better advocate.
What's your sense of how the politics and the atmosphere of today compare to what was happening in the 1980s? And I realize you were a very small child, but you've studied it. You know what was happening in the bigger sense then. How is this time similar or not?
I have Republican colleagues who call themselves Reagan Republicans, and I completely understand what they are referring to. That Reagan Republican era is not the Republican era that we are currently experiencing in the White House. And there is a huge, huge difference. I've seen debates with Reagan. I've seen debates with Bush Sr. where the issue of immigration was spoken about with human dignity. And that's not what we're seeing now. We have a president who talks about human lives and other human beings and calls them animals and calls them rapists and says things like, they're not sending their best. That is not the dignified rhetoric of any leader, much less that who represents the highest office in our nation. And that type of politics has been incredibly divisive, hateful, racist, and it certainly doesn't speak to the overall values of folks that consider themselves Reagan-era Republicans. And there is no irony lost on me that President Reagan was very much involved in American involvement in the war in El Salvador, and that he is a former governor of California, and that I am now on a trip to El Salvador with a governor from California, trying to figure out how to undo all the wrongs that have been done because of American intervention in El Salvador.
I'm still thinking about your comment a few minutes ago when you said to be invited back to the country now compared to the way you left when you were five, smuggled out, trying to escape. What specifically do you remember about getting across the border as a five-year-old?
I actually have quite vivid memories. I remember specifically that I was wearing one of my favorite shirts, which was, remember, it's the 1980s, so I had a Mickey Mouse shirt with red sleeves and the white center. And I remember my hair was in pigtails, and my grandmother told me that I needed to be very quiet and that I needed to be my utmost best so that I wouldn't get in trouble. I felt that things were very serious, and I just tried to, at the time, just be a good granddaughter and listen to my grandmother as we traveled. But I didn't really know what was going on. I knew that we had left our home, and I knew that we were going somewhere new. I remember, as a little girl growing up, speaking to my mother on the phone and seeing photos of her, but never having actually met her because she left when I was very young. And all I have are photos of us. When we were reunited, it felt like a completely new life for me. And that was the beginning of a whole new start, and left everything we knew. And at the time, you know, I'm 5 years old, I don't know what it is that we were leaving. And it wasn't until much later that I fully understood. And then I learned my status about being without legal status, and then had the opportunity, thank God, to have residency and then apply for citizenship in my early 20s. And that has completely changed my life. I was the first one in my family to be able to vote. My four younger sisters were born in Boyle Heights. My mother became a citizen under President Obama, and my father is in the process of becoming a citizen himself. That, I think, is the promise of America and what we all try to do to just improve our circumstance and try to live a better life.
That was Assemblymember Wendy Carrillo talking with us in April of 2019. She was traveling with California Governor Gavin Newsom to El Salvador. There's more of our conversation coming up, including her personal story. This is Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Let's rejoin my conversation from April of 2019 with California Assemblymember Wendy Carrillo. She was part of Governor Gavin Newsom's contingent in El Salvador and the only lawmaker in the group. I asked her, would her own family have immigrated to the U.S. when she was a child if war hadn't been ravaging El Salvador?
If the Civil War had never happened in El Salvador, there's no reason why my family would have immigrated. We were middle class. My grandmother was a nurse. My mother has a bachelor's degree from the University of El Salvador. My father, you know, also a professional. There's no reason why we would have left. The circumstance of war was why we left and why we had to have a new start somewhere else.
I want to fast forward to you winning your assembly seat in a special election in 2017. How many other candidates were in that race?
In the assembly race, there were a total of 11 other men and myself.
So the next question is, how did you win?
Part of my strategy in winning was actually the fact that I had just previously run for the special 34th Congressional District race that Congressman at the time, Javier Becerra, had left to become the AG of California. And the assembly member at the time, Jimmy Gomez, became the congressman. He won that race. And I had run for that race, and I think it set me up to run for the assembly seat. And really quickly, two special elections back-to-back, I announced my congressional run after being at Standing Rock, North Dakota, in the fight for water and tribal sovereignty on December 5th, 2016, following the presidential elections. And I won my assembly seat December 5th, 2017, exactly 1 year later.
I have read this week in an article by Elizabeth Aguilera that this trip for you is, quote, an opportunity to set a tone as to what it really means to be a person for human rights, for LGBT rights, for women's rights, and to really set a new pathway for our state and our country's relationships with El Salvador. Those are huge goals. And how and to what extent do you think that even the beginnings of that are possible given the Trump administration and its policies right now?
We had an incredible roundtable with Salvadorian leaders and NGO leaders with exactly those themes. The rights of women in El Salvador, or the lack thereof, the lack of LGBT rights, human rights in El Salvador. So when the question is asked, why are people immigrating? Why are people fleeing and leaving violence? You have to look at the root cause. And this is something that is very important to California because we play a huge role in our border and our proximity to Mexico. So if people are leaving through a caravan and ending up and seeking asylum, then what's our responsibility as a state? That's question one. And then how do we understand the root causes of why people are leaving? So these are it. There are very limited rights. In fact, if you want to look at what repealing Roe versus Wade in the United States looks like, just look to El Salvador. There is a 100% ban on abortion in El Salvador. In fact, El Salvador is one of four nations around the world that incarcerate women for having a miscarriage, which is often seen as aggravated homicide. So can you imagine being a woman who doesn't know that she is pregnant and has a very natural thing happen to her body and is fearful of going to the doctor and has a miscarriage and then is prosecuted? That's real. That happened. There are women currently in prison because of that. And the United Nations has attempted to work with El Salvador to release those women, and some have been released under President Sanchez Cerén, but some is not all. And so when we talk about women's rights, that's what that looks like, especially when it comes to reproductive rights. There are no, or there are very limited LGBTQ rights. Trans women in El Salvador or trans men in El Salvador have no rights. If you are a trans woman and you, for whatever reason, are arrested and potentially face jail time, there are very limited opportunities as to what your rights are if you are to be incarcerated. And so you can imagine the fear and anxiety that exists within a population of people that are overly persecuted.
With the experiences you've had, the life you've led, and the opportunity that you have in this place of power now, what to you is the true power of your story?
I think the power of my story is that it is the story of millions of people across America and certainly within the state of California. And if people can see themselves in me and people can see that they can achieve success and they can be involved politically and they can make a difference, that's wonderful. If the people of El Salvador can look to me and say, we can achieve that as well, or we have representation that knows our story and that knows our interests because she's lived them, that's powerful. It is also a lot of responsibility to bear. And so I take my job very seriously, and I take the opportunities that I have very seriously to be able to work with the governor, to work with my Assembly and Senate colleagues, to work with our nonprofit groups, to truly advocate for the best for people. Because regardless of what it is that we do in this capacity, when we think of policy, when we think of advocacy, when we think of any type of change that we can make, at the end of the day, we're talking about people's lives. And the everyday person isn't thinking about the political maneuvering of an elected official. They're thinking about, how am I going to pay my rent? How am I going to pay my mortgage? How am I going to put food on the table? How am I going to make sure that I have gas in the car to get to work? And it is our responsibility and duty as the elected officials to make sure that people live their best lives and that they are able to live it in dignity.
Do you believe then that a multitude of these personal stories, as you say, getting into the roots and underneath the headline of what's happening, can be strong enough to change the trajectory of some of the rhetoric that is going in the other direction right now?
I think a lot of the responsibility is also on the media and telling those stories. And having myself having a background in journalism, I look at the way that sometimes these stories are told. Because instead of focusing on the issue that impacts people, sometimes the media can focus on the political maneuvering of someone and why someone is doing something for their own benefit and trying to strategize a larger point of view versus looking at it from the perspective of what are the lives that are going to be impacted. We had incredible conversations with people that have tried to immigrate to the U.S., with women who have been victims of domestic violence, with a young man who just turned 18 and who made the journey when he was 15 because he wanted to help his parents, his mother in particular. And when I saw into his eyes, what I saw was a young boy who was forced to grow up really quickly. We went to an art center where there were 11 and 12-year-olds who were learning to play music, and a local city councilwoman told me that most of those young boys had been rescued from gangs. And the question was, can art and education play a role locally in El Salvador to ensure that these young people have hope for their lives? And so I think those stories, as well as my own, play a huge role in trying to determine what it is that we can do, both federally in terms of the foreign aid that is a necessity in El Salvador and all the groups that receive that aid that help the people find some kind of economic prosperity within the country so that they don't have to leave, as well as the role that the state plays and that the governor plays to ensure that California continues to be a good partner.
Is there anything then that I haven't talked to you about that you want to say at this point in time? I don't want to let this moment go without giving you the opportunity to express what you truly want to express.
I would say that there are two El Salvadors. There is the El Salvador that we often hear about in the news, one that is riddled with violence and poverty. And then there's the other El Salvador that has hope and is working incredibly hard for economic prosperity locally, to improve education, to improve health care, to improve on the issues of human rights. And that's the El Salvador of the future. That's why this foreign aid, or really an investment the United States can do within the country of El Salvador, is huge. Even if we were to look at it something along the lines of the Department of Homeland Security investing in the country, we spend, or the Department of Homeland Security, I should say, spends about $27,000 to detain and repatriate one person back to El Salvador. Those $27,000 can help 33 young people earn employment and get job skills within the NGOs that are currently already working. in El Salvador. And so it's perspective. If we want to curb irregular immigration to the United States, then the foreign aid that is currently being invested in El Salvador helps with that. So cutting those funds will be detrimental to the future of El Salvador, and it's not going to improve the people staying within the country versus immigrating to the United States. And so we have to look at what we're doing as an investment to a nation that needs help, that has huge connections, not only to California, but across the United States, and try to do the best we can so that there's economic stability and economic prosperity within the nation.
A conversation with Assemblymember Wendy Carrillo, who was with Governor Gavin Newsom in El Salvador in April of 2019. We have more favorite conversations to celebrate Insight's 15th birthday at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Let's stay with the topic of immigration and the many kinds of separation that can happen. Reina Grande wrote about this in her new memoir, A Dream Called Home. The book is a sequel to an earlier memoir, The Distance Between Us. Reina was separated from her parents in Mexico and at 9 and a half ran across the U.S. border and became undocumented. Our conversation happened on a Valentine's Day. We talked about the challenge of loving yourself when you've had to live through distances or separations from your parents.
First was a geographical distance when they immigrated and left me behind in Mexico. And then there was the emotional distance that was created because of family separation. And then there were other distances like language. Once I learned English and my parents didn't, language became a distance. My assimilation and acculturation became a distance. My education also became a distance when I ended up going to university when my parents only went to elementary school. And the new book, A Dream Called Home, I write about my search for a home, for a place to belong. I had been dreaming about a home since I was a child when my parents immigrated. And in this new book, I write about the search for it and the realization that the only person who could ever give me a home was me.
In learning to love yourself, what have you put in place about there and here, distance and closeness, and the coming into oneself that supersedes anything that immigration divides?
Learning to love myself has helped me to heal the little girl in me that was abandoned by her parents, because I grew up with that image of myself. You know, I was the parentless child, the motherless child, the orphan in my hometown. People could be very cruel to kids who go through this experience of being left behind. And I grew up with a very low self-esteem. You know, I felt unloved. I felt unwanted. And it took me a long time to realize that my parents leaving me was an act of love. they left me because they were trying to find something better for me. But it took me a long time to realize that, because as a child, I just knew they had left and they hadn't taken me with them. So it really affected the way I saw myself. Once I got here and I realized that immigration had driven a wedge between us, and it took so much effort to constantly try to reconnect, my self-esteem didn't really improve. It also played a big part on the way I interacted with other people, with relationships that I had with other men. So it took a long time. And I can say, I think now at my age, I finally realize, you know, that I need to love myself and I need to heal from all of those experiences to let go of what that initial abandonment did to me.
How much did you watch the scenes and the sounds from the border?
It's really hard to watch that. You know, it's really hard to see what families are going through. I find it very difficult to see the way children are treated and how they're torn away from their parents. For me, like, it just brings back some really bad memories. I find it really heartbreaking that this is happening to so many families. And I just think about the lasting trauma that these children are going to have for the rest of their lives.
There is something called immigrant trauma.
Yes.
It's something you didn't know anything about. What have you learned about to what degree and in what ways it stays with your life and with you for the rest of your life?
I don't think we ever get over it. We definitely learn how to live with it, and we learn to overcome it at times, but it always comes back. And it's been really helpful for me, because when I write, I'm able to finally find the words to describe how I felt. You know, when I started writing when I was 13, I didn't know how to express how I felt. I just knew there was a lot of turmoil inside. I didn't even know the word trauma, the word depression, or PTSD, anxiety, all of those words. That vocabulary was not mine. And I learned to express my feelings through stories. And that's how stories help me to cope with all the traumatic events in my life. Now, as an adult, I'm starting to read more articles, essays about what I experience, and I'm able to finally find the terms for all of that happened to me. One of the latest terms that I've discovered is subtractive bilingualism. I've been writing about that. I actually just read, I wrote an essay that's going to be published by CNN, where I talk about my experiences with U.S. schools and trying to learn English and being shamed and threatened into learning the language and being forced to give up my native tongue, and how little by little my Spanish was replaced by English, to the point where I began to feel ashamed of my mother because she never learned English. Mm. I never wrote in Spanish. After I was 13 and I learned English, I have never, in the past 30 years, never written in Spanish again. I failed to teach my children Spanish because of the trauma of being an English learner and being shamed about speaking Spanish. I came upon that term, subtractive bilingualism, and I realized, like, now I have the word to describe what happened to me.
I remember you saying that as a young writer being encouraged, your teachers said to you, write the book that you wanted to read. Write the book that you were looking for that you couldn't find. Has it occurred to you that so many young people and families caught up in the immigration battles at the border right now will look to many books, including yours, that are being written right now as healing?
I think that it's important for people who go through these experiences to be able to see themselves in stories, you know, to see themselves in books. Is such a powerful experience, because you realize your experience does matter, that you do exist. And more powerfully is the realization that you're not alone.
When a family has been separated in these circumstances, like yours was, to what degree do you think it can be put back together again?
Well, I think it depends on the family. I think some families manage to put themselves back together and to work hard at staying together and overcoming that separation. Other families like mine are not able to do that. My family, we were dealing with alcoholism. We were dealing with some bad things like, you know, a history of violence in the family. And we were not very successful at putting ourselves back together.
A lot of the second book, in fact, has you working through the relationships with your parents. Mm-hmm. But the relationships with your grandmother, too, mothers. There's a vivid scene in which you're told now as a young adult the truth about how one of your grandmothers ended up becoming the wife of your grandfather. And that was a shocking piece of the past, wasn't it?
It was very shocking because my maternal grandmother, when I was growing up with her, she used to go visit my grandfather's grave every week. And she had a photo of him on her altar, and he was surrounded by candles and flowers, and she was so devoted to him. And I thought, wow, they must have had such a beautiful, you know, love. Mm-hmm. And then when I was in college, I went to visit my grandma in Mexico, and she told me the story. And she said that my grandfather had basically put a knife to her throat and said, you know, you gotta be my woman or I'm gonna kill you. And it was so traumatic to realize that that was their story. And here I was imagining something completely different. In that Dream Called Home, I write a lot about these stories, you know, that I write about my mother's story of how she ended up with my father, which was in a very violent way as well. And then I write about my own love experiences and how they also ended up in bad ways. And the hard lessons that I learned from those experiences.
You're extremely truthful in almost a raw way, Raina.
Sometimes I feel that maybe I expose myself too much. But at the same time, for me, writing memoir, it's not about writing the good things. When I write memoir, it's for me to try to understand the bad stuff, you know, my mistakes, write about my mistakes and what I learned from them, and to be really honest with the bad choices that I made, the situations I put myself in or I found myself in, and then how I struggled to get out of those situations. I don't write to tap myself on the back and say, oh, look at me, I've done so many great things, because I've done a lot of bad things too.
Raina, what's your thought about a wall? And how might a wall have changed your family history?
I don't believe in walls. I don't think that they work. They send the wrong message. But also, most importantly, I think walls force us to avoid looking at the situation and really addressing the situation. You know, we look the other way and pretend that nothing is going on that other side of the wall. So to me, it's more important to look at what is the reality, what's going on, how did we contribute to it, how can we help, what are the things that we can do as a society to make sure we're not seeing millions of people who are fleeing their homes. We really have to ask ourselves, what can we do to help them stay home? What can we do to stop creating all of the instability that is causing this situation? And it's just a Band-Aid, and it's not going to address the problem.
Is love the most powerful force still?
I think love has the power to make us be better people. You know, when we love others, love ourselves, when we love our planet, when we love our community and our country, and when we are guided by love, we can be more compassionate, be more forgiving, be more generous.
That was author Raina Grande talking about her new memoir, A Dream Called Home, in February of 2019. There are more of our favorite conversations at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Insight is produced by Cody Drabble and Kate Gonzalez. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. We had help from Helen Barrington and Antonio Muniz. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.